I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Sonia Sotomayor. It's a name many Americans are just getting used to and one they may hear for a while. President Barack Obama today nominated her for a job for life and the job of a lifetime. If confirmed, she will be the first Hispanic on the U.S. Supreme Court.
When Sonia Sotomayor ascends those marble steps to assume her seat on the highest court of the land, America will have taken another important step towards realizing the ideal that is etched above its entrance. Equal justice under the law.
54-year-old federal appeals judge Sonia Sotomayor would replace retiring Supreme Court Justice David Souter. She is a New York-raised daughter of Puerto Rican immigrants who grew up in a Bronx housing project but went on to study at Princeton and Yale.
This wealth of experiences, personal and professional, have helped me to understand, respect, and respond to all litigants who appear before me.
Let's get a roundup of response, and let's start with Yale Law Professor Heather Gerken. Professor, your initial reaction?
It's a pretty inspiring story. I mean, if the measure of a person is how far they've come, then Judge Sotomayor has come farther than almost anyone else who's ever been on the court.
Well, and it started early on. We have been learning more about her personal story. She loved Nancy Drew books as a girl, but was inspired to become a judge at the age of 10. While watching Perry Mason, she saw that it ended with the camera on the judge. And as she told the Associated Press years later, she realized then that the judge was the most important player. So, you know, hers is a very attractive story. But how might her backstory inform her decisions?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, in some ways, we sort of expect judges to come to the court as if they were blank slates, and of course they never do. And I guess the hope is that someone who's actually come from a place where she's had to struggle, who's experienced discrimination in her life, the hope would be that she could bring some of that experience to illuminate the questions in front of the court. So Justice Marshall, for a long time, played that role on the court when he was alive. He was an African-American. He had actually been racially stopped.
He was stopped by police because he was Black.
Exactly. And he was able to sort of impart to a bunch of generally wealthy white justices what it was like to be Black. And Justice O'Connor has said that he changed her view on some of these cases because he was able to relate to her what it was like to live in America and be discriminated against. And it's important for the court to be able to think about that question, even if not all of them have had that kind of experience.
Well, but that might get into some tricky minefields for President Obama during the nomination process. Judge Sotomayor has said in a 2001 speech at UC Berkeley that she would hope that a wise Latina woman with the richness of her experience would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hadn't lived that life. And President Obama has said he wants a nominee with empathy. Republicans are saying that means an activist judge.
Well, I think that Judge Sotomayor is saying something that we all know to be true, which is we all bring ourselves to our jobs. I think it's a little bit foolish to equate the notion that you have a history with the idea that you're going to be a quote-unquote activist judge, which is simply nowadays a label we use to attach judges who do the things that we don't like.
We've got Jonathan Turley standing by. Now, he said today that he thinks Sonia Sotomayor is the highest risk nomination that Obama could have made, and he's concerned about the Ricci case. I'm just going to sum this up briefly. In 2004, New Haven city officials threw out the results of a fire department promotional exam because they said it yielded racially lopsided promotions. A group of white and Latino firefighters passed the test at twice the rate of the Black candidates, and so they sued. Sotomayor was on the appeals board that rejected their claims. The Supreme Court has now agreed to review that case. Now, might we have an appointee or a nominee to the Supreme Court whose opinion is potentially reversed by that Supreme Court?
Well, we've had nominees before that have had their cases reversed by the Supreme Court. It happens pretty often to appellate judges. And one should note here that she was applying what is considered to be pretty old precedent under Title VII. And by old precedent, I mean precedent that was decided by a much more liberal court than this one is. So if she gets reversed, it is as much about the new composition of the court as it is about the law. I haven't seen anyone make an argument that she misapplied existing precedent. The difference between the Supreme Court and the appellate court is when you're in the appellate court, you have to do what the Supreme Court says. When you're in the Supreme Court, you can decide to take the law in new directions.
Well, and it's interesting, too, in that case that she did overturn not just the white but the Latino firefighters in favor of throwing out the tests.
Yeah, well, this idea that seems to be floating around already in the commentary that because she's a woman, because she's Latina, that she's going to rule a certain way on cases.
And well, I just have to stop you there for a second because she herself said that would affect her ruling. She, you know, when she said that a wise Latina woman would reach a better conclusion than a white male, which some would see as equally insulting to assume that a white male, because of his background, couldn't reach that conclusion.
Well, I think people always phrase things poorly. I think the way to understand this is that everyone brings their experience onto the court, and it is useful to have a court with a diverse set of experiences on which they can draw. But that is different from having someone who witlessly rules in one direction or another simply based on their own identity. And I think that that's a distinction that we should all be able to draw. Otherwise, it's impossible to have judges, because every judge brings his or her background to the court. So what we want is a court that's able to think about these issues, to understand the rich experience that is the United States when they're answering these questions. And she actually is quite different from most of the justices on the court who've had quite privileged backgrounds. It would be useful to have them talk about these things together.
Well, and so you sound very much in favor of the nomination. What else do you think Sonia Sotomayor will bring to the bench?
As a woman in the legal profession, it's actually just nice to know that the Supreme Court looks a little bit like the legal profession. I mean that not in the sense that I think there has to be any sort of quota on the number of women, but I spent a lot of time teaching women at the Yale Law School. It would be useful for them to have someone like Sonia Sotomayor on the court, a smart, extremely competent judge at the highest level of our profession.
Heather Gerken, Yale Law School professor, thanks so much for weighing in with us.
Thanks so much.
And let's open this up a little now with Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you.
And Edward Whalen, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., former law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Ed Whalen, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Robin.
And let's start with you, Jonathan, because you today said that Justice Sotomayor is the highest risk nomination that Obama could pick because she sided with the city of New Haven against those white and Latino firemen who sued. Why is that so important to you?
Well, first of all, it's not just that case, although I think that case does raise serious questions. I think that she can be legitimately criticized, as she was, by a Clinton nominee on the court for basically dismissing these arguments without serious consideration. One of the Clinton appointees said, you know, this is pretty outrageous. These are really serious questions, and you guys are just dismissing it without talking about the constitutional implications. I think these firefighters raised a legitimate question, and she did not give it much consideration. But there's other cases. There's the Grant case in 1999. This was a case where she ruled in favor of finding that a student had been discriminated against because based on his performance in the first grade, he was sent back to the kindergarten. There are cases like Riverkeeper, which was ultimately the issue there was addressed by the Supreme Court and reversed, was an EPA case. I think that there's going to be a number of cases like that that will fuel some of the controversy. I'm not personally as concerned about those cases as I am the fact that I've read about 30 of her opinions, and those opinions, when you read them, these are her most important opinions, don't speak out that this is a person who should be on the Supreme Court. I mean, if you look at the body of her legal work, it's not particularly profound. It's not particularly impressive. It's not the type of work that you say, of all of the judges that are available here, including, most importantly, Diane Wood on the Seventh Circuit, this is the one who deserves to be elevated.
Well,
it's just not.
Well, I want to take a further look at that, but first, Ed Whalen, bring you in. The Conservative Judicial Confirmation Network points out that Judge Sotomayor's got a 100% reversal rate as a court of appeals judge. Many of her decisions have been overturned. But she certainly, I mean, progressives, liberals, are very unhappy with the choice. They don't think they wanted a Scalia of the left. They don't think she's that. So your thoughts on this nomination?
Well, I think that the Ricci firefighters case that Jonathan mentioned is of real concern. There, she resorted to procedural shenanigans to bury the claims of these white and Hispanic firefighters who had been denied promotion because the city of New Haven didn't like the racial profile of those who did well on the promotional exam. Clinton appointee Jose Cabranes, not just a Clinton appointee but a Hispanic, wrote a dissent from a hearing en banc that excoriated Sotomayor and her colleagues for the improper way they handled that case.
Well, and again, for those who didn't hear us, set it up. New Haven, the city, threw out these test results because they felt that the results were racially skewed. They felt that the test was somehow skewed. The whites and one Latino, I believe, who did well on the test subsequently sued. And some are saying that at the Supreme Court, this is now going to be sort of a decision that could change how employers do comply with the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But, you know, overall, your thoughts on her as the nominee?
Well, Robin, there's no claim on the city's part that the test was skewed. Everyone agrees that this is a legitimate test. They just,
the results
like the results,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they threw it out on that basis. Look, I think what you see here is a concrete example of how dangerous President Obama's lawless empathy standard can be in practice.
The empathy. Let's just remind people. He said he wanted a judge with empathy.
Well, he said more than that, a lot more than that, and I certainly agree that a judge's experiences are inevitably going to inform his or her judgments on certain matters, and in some narrow cases, perhaps properly so. But what President Obama has said is that in difficult cases, the critical ingredient is supplied by what is in the judge's heart. That's an exact quote. He wants judges to indulge what he calls their deepest values, core concerns, and the depth and breadth of their empathy in deciding cases. Well, that's not judging. That's making it up on the bench, and it's a very dangerous approach that all folks ought to be concerned about. And the white firefighters, the sort of folks who risked their lives on 9/11, and for whom we recently had some sort of appreciation, you know, those are stark victims of the Obama empathy
approach. Well, Jonathan Turley, we mentioned in our conversation with Professor Gerking Sotomayor's comments at Berkeley that as a Latina and a woman, she could come to a better conclusion on some cases than a white male who hadn't had experience. Now, some might look at that as being overly empathic, but Heather Gerken says that's nothing new. Justice O'Connor said that former Justice Marshall helped her, O'Connor, to understand what it was like to be stopped just for being black, that his being black and inserting those personal feelings helped her to make decisions.
Well, I have to say, you know, first of all, I have to say that I believe she should be confirmed. I don't believe there is a basis in these opinions to not vote for her. I think the president deserves a lot of deference. I don't believe this was the strongest nominee, and I believe that liberals, putting aside the short-term elation, will come to regret this. They had the chance to put on a liberal Scalia, someone who would change the intellectual debate, at least move the center of gravity of the court. They're not going to get that, in my view, with this nominee. But I think her remarks were unfortunate. I don't think people should defend those remarks. I don't think that she is going to write a better opinion because of her experiences. She might write as good an opinion because of her intellect, but I think that it's a real problem when those issues become the criteria here. I think that she made a couple of speeches that were very, very unfortunate. The other thing is that I think that she does follow the model of Thurgood Marshall, but Thurgood Marshall was a great justice because he was the first, as she will be, as the first Latina. But I'll also remind you, Thurgood Marshall's contribution in terms of the long-term role of his decisions is very small. He did not have a lasting intellectual impact.
That's Professor Jonathan Turley of George Washington University Law School. Jonathan, we're coming up against the break. Edward Whalen's with us as well, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington. You've both given us a lot to chew on here. Is nominee Sotomayor too empathetic? Is she going to be drawing too much on her own personal experience? And does she have the gravitas, as others are asking? We will address that when we come back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking about President Obama's first Supreme Court nomination, Federal Appeals Court Judge Sonia Sotomayor, who, if confirmed, would become the first Hispanic and third woman on the high court. And this morning she had some comments about that.
It is a daunting feeling to be here. 11 years ago, during my confirmation process for appointment to the Second Circuit, I was given a private tour of the White House. It was an overwhelming experience for a kid from the South Bronx, yet never in my wildest childhood imaginings did I ever dream that I would live this moment.
We've been speaking with Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University, and Edward Whalen, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and a former law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. If I can synopsize, gentlemen, I think, Jonathan, you've been saying that you think Sotomayor should be confirmed but isn't the best choice the Obama administration has made. And, Ed, I think I'm hearing you say that it's not a good choice at all?
Well, I think that's right, and I think the confirmation process is an opportunity to debate what the proper role of the courts is and to explore President Obama's lawless empathy standard and just how it is that Sotomayor fits that standard.
Well, but how about she hasn't been, though, tilting totally to the left on her decisions. I'm thinking of her decision, which I'm trying to find here, on abortion and the ability. She sided with the government, saying that justices, let's see, I'm trying to find it here, saying that the government could deny abortion spending in international for international organizations because it's public monies, which came as a surprise to many on the left. So she's not entirely tilted to the left.
Well, that was a case where there was a direct precedent on point, and I don't think that we need to give circuit judges too much credit for simply complying with precedent. The question is what happens when she's liberated from that precedent, and I think that President Obama knows whom he's picking.
Well, and Jonathan Turley, you've said that you fear that she may not have the depth for a Supreme Court nominee, that nothing from her writings jumps out at you. And I'm reading something that liberal commentator Jeffrey Rosen writes. He says that he spoke with Judge Sotomayor's former law clerks. None of them raves about her, he writes, but further, they expressed reservation about her temperament, her judicial craftsmanship, her ability to provide an intellectual counterweight to the conservative judges. One said she's not that smart. These are, kind of terrible things to be hearing on a day where so much was celebrated today in Washington. You know, her backstory, her, coming from Bronx housing to Princeton and Yale. But your sense on what that means?
Well, I think the backstory is driving this nomination. I think we have to be honest that without that backstory, this would be a collection of very unremarkable opinions. And, you have to be objective enough to say, is this the body of work where you would look at it and say, wow, this person really should be on the highest court to shape the law? And the answer, in my view, is rather plain. It's not. I mean, it's not a remarkable amount of work. She, unlike Justice Roberts, she's been on the court a long time. And unlike Judge Woods on the Seventh Circuit, she's not viewed as a standout intellectual. And so I think the backstory is driving it. Now, should the backstory be given that much weight in the selection of a justice? I must be honest. My answer is no, because the short-term pleasure that many of us get from this very impressive and moving personal story, I think will be outweighed in the long term. The conservatives have gotten huge dividends out of Justice Scalia because it's not just that he is something of a firebrand. In fact, I think that's a bit of a liability. It's that he writes opinions that move the intellectual center of gravity of the court. And he's respected by academics even that disagree with him. And so I do think that it's an unfortunate choice in that sense. There's no question that she's smart. Her performance at Princeton and Yale are really incredible. But all of these nominees are smart. You can be very, very smart and not have a profound view of the law. And I think that's the concern many academics have.
Ed Whalen, you were, as we said, law clerk for Justice Scalia. Here are some of the other Sotomayor decisions. She, her most notable ruling probably in March 95 when she scolded baseball owners for unfair labor practices but got players back from that major baseball strike. She also released the suicide note of former Clinton White House aide Vince Foster under the Freedom of Information Act. The Wall Street Journal had sued. How do you think conservatives and Republicans, give us the headline of the attack against her in the coming days?
Well, look, I'm as much of a baseball fan as anyone, but the idea that President Obama is going to hide behind her baseball ruling and touting her qualifications is rather humorous. Look, the problem is the Ricci firefighters case shows that she has a record of indulging her policy preferences, and we need to have a debate over that, over President Obama's empathy standard, and I think the American people already understand overwhelmingly that that's not the right approach for a justice. It's interesting, you quoted her before as saying that when she saw the judge in Perry Mason and realized the judge was the most important player, well, that's a stark contrast with Chief Justice Roberts' image of the judge as umpire.
Well, and Jonathan Turley, even so, do you think that this nomination is a sure thing, or do you think these things you've been talking about will be stumbling blocks?
No, I don't think there'll be stumbling blocks. They should be, but both Republican and Democratic senators have never really been concerned about intellectual depth. They seem to feel uncomfortable even talking about it, and that's never been a barrier to even Court of Appeals nominations. I think that she, in fact, will get through. I also believe that her opinions do not suggest that she is this wild-eyed liberal. I reading her opinions, I was struck that she does, in fact, rule on both sides of the political aisle. That's not what concerns me in the slightest. So I do think that she will be confirmed.
That's Professor Jonathan Turley of George Washington University Law School and Ed Whalen, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, taking a closer look at President Obama's first Supreme Court nominee, Judge Sonia Sotomayor, a name that will become very familiar in the weeks ahead as her career is much discussed. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with the latest news and also a look at Clowns Without Borders. You're listening to Here and Now. South Korea announced today that it will join a U.S.-led nonproliferation campaign, something in the past North Korea has said would be tantamount to an act of war. But South Korea took the move after North Korea launched two short-range missiles today and an underground nuclear test yesterday. Why is North Korea doing this? Aidan Foster Carter is an expert on Korea and an honorary senior research fellow at Leeds University in England. Aidan, what do you think is behind these missile launches?
I think they're looking both outwards and inwards. I mean, they may, in their crazy, stupid way, be trying to get President Obama's attention. Why it's crazy and stupid is, of course, they had it anyway. We know that President Obama is ready to listen to countries America has regarded as foes before. We're seeing real progress already with Cuba. All they really had to do was wait. But conversely, firing, first of all, a big missile last month, now this nuclear test, is actually going to make things more difficult. That's why, secondly, I think it makes slightly more sense for a domestic audience. I am being speculative here. North Korean internal politics is a black box, really. We don't know what happens, but we know Kim Jong-il, the leader, was unwell last year. They don't have a succession in place. That makes them vulnerable. I think, and there's some evidence for this, that they're trying to put a succession in place, which they will announce, maybe one of his sons. And it's kind of the way they do things, to bark even louder while delicate stuff like that is going on. You do kind of wonder how that goes down in a country where most people really do have to struggle to find enough to eat.
Well, and some observers might say that another reason could be that North Korea really does mean to flex its muscle and do something with the weapons. Do you think that's a possibility?
I doubt that on the whole, although there's various doing something. There's an angle for this that hasn't been brought out enough. I mean, even when George W. Bush had switched to engaging North Korea, the six-party talks were going on, suddenly there was this mystery facility in Syria that the Israelis bombed, and the consensus seems to be, though obviously those concerned deny it, that the North Koreans were very helpfully providing something nuclear to the Syrians. Now, you know, you'd think that would be a complete red line for any U.S. administration, proliferation to the Middle East. I don't think they are bent on world domination. This is a state almost collapsing. I think in their paranoid way they do fear others, except they then behave in ways that make us afraid of them. But there is a proliferation risk as well.
That they might want to sell these. Well, South Korea announced it would join the PSI, this American-led campaign to stop proliferation, including things like searching ships thought to be carrying nuclear cargo. They made that announcement today. Your thoughts on that move by South Korea, which we've said in the past, North Korea has said that if the South joined PSI, it was tantamount to an act of war.
I must say, I think this is fairly typical of the pointlessness of South Korean policy. I mean, don't get me wrong, most of this stuff is North Korea's fault. That said, South Korea, the president, Lee Myung-bak, has been in power about a year. He reversed 10 years of dialogue, much as Bush did with Clinton's policy towards North Korea. And I know people can argue the toss from all sides of the spectrum, but I reckon it was working. It was one-sided, but we had channels of dialogue. Seoul was building up influence. You join PSI, I mean, you know, it's like we used to say, sending a gunboat. The serious stuff, like North Korean missiles for Iran, which is a serious stuff, it travels by air across Chinese airspace. Somebody going to shoot that down? I don't think so.
What do you think happens now? The UN has said it's working on putting more sanctions in place, but as you said, this is a country that's already starving. China in the past hasn't supported strong punitive measures against its ally North Korea, but some are saying that might be changing. And then there's talks that the six-party talks could be revived. What do you think happens next?
I'm sure that somewhere further down the line there will be talks in some forum. What it will be exactly, I don't know. I think that difficult though it is, because we're all obviously angry, and you can't let a nuclear test go unremarked. Nonetheless, one has to listen open so in case more sensible signals do ever come from them. So right now, UN Security Council resolutions, people can try sanctions, but it's a very isolated and impoverished state, and it's unclear whether China, which is the only power with real leverage, would actually implement them. If I'm right about the succession stuff and the domestic side of things, we kind of have to be patient and keep our ears open in case a more sensible message comes out of the place, and meanwhile, of course, being vigilant.
Aidan Foster Carter, an expert on Korea and an honorary senior research fellow at Leeds University in England on the recent nuclear tests in North Korea. Aidan, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, Calvin apparently hasn't learned yet that lions need their sleep, but he may pick that up along with other wildlife facts because he's visiting a zoo accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. The trade organization requires its members to educate visitors about wildlife and actively engage in conservation projects. There are more than 2,000 zoos in the U.S. in major cities, suburban neighborhoods, but fewer than 10% are accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and still 175 million people visit AZA zoos every year, more than all major sporting events combined. In the public radio documentary From Cages to Conversation, American Zoos Inside Out, producer Diane Toomey looks at whether zoos actually fulfill their mission to inspire visitors to help save wildlife.
There should be some frogs back here.
I think it's mine.
You got it. Awesome. Yay. So you're going to put it in the bucket? And you're gonna gently.
At the Franklin Park Zoo in Boston, a staff member uses plastic frogs to teach kids about a fungus attacking amphibians worldwide.
We want to take care of the frogs. You're going to give them some medicine. Just spray them. Swish them around a little bit. And then, you know what good scientists do? They put him back in the wild so he's safe and sound. And we make sure he's well.
At the Oakland Zoo, a keeper talks about the challenges of caring for meerkats.
They bite.
They do bite. They're very, very mean bites.
How do you make them bite?
I don't make them, but they're still wild animals.
The Association of Zoos and Aquariums believes these moments inspire children and adults to take action on behalf of wildlife. Paul Boyle is the Senior Vice President for Conservation and Education at the AZA. He says even the smallest of zoo encounters can be life-changing, like when a child gets close to an elephant.
It changes the way they think about elephants. It changes the way they think about the place where elephants live. It changes their thinking about their place in the world. It, over time, builds their sense of respect for wildlife.
Show me the figures. Show me the money.
Richard Farinato worked in zoos for more than 15 years, holding various positions, including assistant director of the Greenville Zoo in South Carolina. He now works for the Humane Society of the United States.
If the zoo were so effective in its conservation message, more people would be out there doing conservation in their daily lives and thinking about conservation and supporting conservation with money.
I used to think that zoos had education as their central purpose.
David Hancox is the former director of Seattle's Woodland Park Zoo and has worked for zoos in the U.S. and abroad for nearly four decades.
I'm convinced now that all these claims that zoos make about we inspire people to take action or change their lifestyle or make a contribution to conservation, no evidence at all, none at all, that that's having any effect.
Hancox is right about the evidence. No research has ever looked at whether a zoo visit inspires people to help save wildlife. But a few studies have examined whether zoos educate their visitors. And the results suggest zoos are struggling. A study done by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums itself found that only 10% of zoo-goers surveyed learned anything during their visit. And an independent study found that the average time visitors spent at an exhibit was 99 seconds, and only about one quarter of them read the signs.
The public doesn't necessarily want to learn when they come to a zoo.
Jeff Heisen is a history professor at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia and an expert on American zoos. He says since the first one, the Central Park Menagerie, opened its doors in the mid-1800s, educating the American public has always been a challenge.
People walk into a zoo And what they want is to see exotic, active animals up close. And to me, that's always been the fundamental public idea of what you do at a zoo.
Indeed, numerous studies have found that most people go to the zoo not to be educated, but to be entertained. And these days, there's an entertaining alternative to the zoo.
In this world, power only belongs to the strongest, the fiercest, and sometimes the most unexpected.
At any hour of the day, there's a myriad of television channels featuring animals. Discovery, National Geographic, even the Sundance Channel. Here's actress Isabella Rossellini doing her best imitation of a snail searching for a mate.
I can produce darts. I use them to inflict pain on my partners before mating. It turns me on.
So if you can see eating, killing, and even mating right in your living room, what does the zoo have that TV doesn't? Jennifer Gershom is director of education at Boston's Franklin Park Zoo.
The animals here are real. They're close. You can watch them. You can smell them. You can hear them. You know, when you're standing in front of the lion and he roars, you feel it in your sternum. It's not something that you can get from Animal Planet.
It's hard to deny that when people see an animal at the zoo, something pretty incredible can happen. This is what happens when polar bears swim by an underwater viewing area at the Detroit Zoo. So even though there's no hard evidence yet that you need to see an animal before you'll want to help save it in the wild, doesn't it seem pretty logical? Former Woodland Park Zoo director David Hancock points to one of the most popular conservation efforts in history and says no.
There's a very high percentage of people in the Western world who believe that it's wrong to hunt whales and who are concerned about wanting to save them. But there's a very, very minute percentage of people who have ever seen a whale in its wild habitat.
Regardless, zoos say when it comes to conservation, they're doing more than just educating and inspiring the public. They're participating in conservation projects such as breeding programs. Although critics argue that since only a handful of animals are ever reintroduced into the wild, it's not conservation. Still, Chris Veers, the executive director of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, says zoos are on par with environmental powerhouses like the Sierra Club and Conservation International.
AZA institutions in the last 5 years have contributed $89 million in 100 countries and 3,700 conservation projects.
But critics say zoos should be doing more worldwide. This question of how much is enough is posed in a climate where some zoos are able to spend millions of dollars, 40, 50, 60 million, on just one exhibit. Peter Knights is the executive director of WildAid, an organization that works to stop the illegal wildlife trade. He says a fraction of this money could make a big difference protecting a nature reserve in Africa.
We've supported parks in the past where for $1 million a year, you're basically picking up the entire salaries of the rangers, their equipment and their fuel and keeping the park running. So like everything else, money spent in the developing world can go an awful lot further than it can here in the United States.
WildAid works with AZA zoos on a number of projects, and Knights calls AZA standards some of the best in the world. But he says if he was given millions to help wildlife, he'd use it differently.
It wouldn't be to expand an enclosure. It would be to help safeguard their protection in the wild.
Whether or not zoos are falling short in their conservation efforts is open to interpretation. But historian Jeff Heisen explains why the stakes for zoos are so high.
It's not like a museum or a library that simply has books or artifacts. Obviously, this is a very strange institution in that what it displays is alive.
That last word from historian Jeff Heisen in the documentary From Cages to Conservation, American Zoos Inside Out by reporter Diane Toomey and producer Christina Russo. It's airing on public radio stations across the country from where you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. But tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll see what they found when they took a look at the scrutiny zoos are under for treatment of one of their prime attractions, elephants. That's tomorrow. Just ahead, clowns without borders trying to bring smiles to Haiti. You're listening to Here and Now.
You've probably heard of the emergency medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, but have you heard of Clowns Without Borders? It started in Spain in 1993. 9 countries, including the U.S., now have chapters. And this month, volunteer teams of professional clowns will be dispatched to Kosovo, Moldova, Sudan, and Lesotho, where, as their mission statement says, they will offer laughter to relieve the suffering of all persons, especially children, in conflict zones and emergencies. This year, the U.S. branch of Clowns Without Borders is making Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, its focus. Boston-based Leah Abel has clowned for the corporate world and cruise ships. She recently returned from her first Clowns Without Borders trip to Haiti and joins us in the studio. Welcome, Leah.
Hello. Thank you.
Funny, you don't look like a clown, but you're not in your clown getup now.
I try to dress appropriately.
Well, and what was it like in Haiti, and what do you do there? For instance, your characters, who are they, and how would they interact with kids in Haiti?
Well, we all have a number of different characters. On this last trip, there were 4 of us that went. There's usually 3 or 4 people that go in a group. And we develop a show, about an hour, maybe more. And then we go into villages, or we go to schools or to community groups, or we perform on the street, to orphanages or a number of different places, and we go put on a show for the people and the kids there.
Is it mostly miming, or for those who've seen her, like Grandma in, you know, the Big Apple Circus, where there's not a lot of language?
Yes. Yeah. It's almost entirely nonverbal. Yeah, and that way we can reach a lot of people.
Well, and I'm just wondering, are clowns universal? You've just been to Haiti, but mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there are stories of other Clowns Without Borders going to other countries where they don't have clowns.
We don't go with white face and big shoes. So it's not clown that a lot of people necessarily think of. It's more physical comedy, I guess. We consider ourselves clowns because of our training and our background and maybe our community. But it's not necessarily like do-do-do-do-do-do-do kind of clown. So, you know, sometimes we wear noses during the show and a little bit of makeup. Sometimes we don't. It depends. We draw on situations that are universal. And so in that way, the comedy is universal.
Right. Give us an example. You probably don't pull up in a Volkswagen and have 20 of you get out. But give us an example of something you might do that you see children's eyes light up in Haiti.
Well, let's see. The juggling is always a big hit. We do, on this last trip, David, who was on the trip with us, he did a bit, we called it copycat. So he would do something and he'd have a child from the audience come and would copy every move, but then he would sort of make him mess up. And the crowd always loves that mm-hmm. because, you know, they get to see somebody that they know up on stage. We'll run into each other and fall down. We do acrobalance, so we stand on each other's shoulders, right. That kind of thing.
Well, we understand the way it works practically is that your travel and expenses are paid while you're there. You and 3 other clowns, as you said, did 20 performances and 11 workshops in 12 days. It sounds like a lot of work. But you also have some requirements. There's a sort of a code of ethics that you're not allowed to evangelize and that you have an obligation to testify in the kind of injustices that you've witnessed. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. Well, we try and stick to our mission, which is no child without a smile. We don't come with any other message. So the way we stick to that is by sticking to the positive and doing what we're there to do and leaving alone everything else. And I saw so much. It still sort of blows my mind and creeps into my dreams at night. The thing that struck me the most, I'd have to say, was the amount of garbage that I saw. There was garbage and trash littering all of the streets. We went into one community where we kind of hiked up a dirt path, and the bottom was thick with garbage. We were walking on garbage. And a lot of the kids there don't have shoes and that kind of thing. And it was also where the water was running down. So the lack of clean water for kids to drink, because we were asked after, I would say, every single show, did we have water? Also, I really didn't see a lot of people smile. And I think poverty and oppression there affects people's psychological condition. Yeah. And that's why we target such areas to go there.
Well, and not seeing them smile, but also one of your fellow clowns points out a look she's seen before at an orphanage, and it's a deadening in the eyes of kids when you say you've got to leave. Did you see that, and what do you think?
Yes, and I think that part of it is there's a lot of missionary work there, and there's this feeling of people come in and they give you what they give you, and then they leave. And I think maybe especially for orphans that's their situation anyway. And then it's being repeated. It feels like it's being reinforced. And that was very hard to be a part of, even though you felt, right beforehand, we were running around the yard and screaming and laughing and playing jump rope and had crazy music playing and dancing and carrying one another and playing with balls and having a great time. And then it's like, goodbye. And we leave and there is a real sadness in the eyes. I mean, there's a thankfulness, there's a gratefulness, but there's also a sadness.
Yeah. Do you think, though, given that it's, what would you say that overall it did? I mean, if it left children feeling you're leaving us, why do it? I mean, there's got to be a reason.
Well, I guess I can answer that best by what somebody said to us at one of the nonprofits that we worked with. We put on a show and he said, to give us this momentary relief is so great because it's an escape. It's an escape, even if for just a short while. And I know here where I live comparatively in the lap of luxury, I sometimes need to go to the movies or just sit down and read a book, or I need to zone out and space out so that I can sort of relax my body and then, re-attack the world. And I think that what we do there is give that. And we also know that groups that have gone back year after year to the same places that they have, taken on doing our acts, or they'll learn how to juggle. So even though what we leave behind isn't necessarily material, that we do leave something behind that we can see manifests later. So I don't think that I think that the good certainly outweighs the bad. And I know that for myself, I still think about the good times that I had there, even, a few months later. And if they get the same thing out of it, then I think it's very beneficial. Even if there was a sad moment, it doesn't necessarily color the entire time.
Right. That's Leah Abel from Clowns Without Borders. She recently returned from Haiti. Leah, thanks so much for telling us about it.
Thank you.